I still owe you more than I can ever know. Heinrich looked at his watch. Ah, it's getting late. Come and meet my son and wife. Jean nodded and pushed back from the bar. I can't think of a better idea. The Cubs game had ended, and Skinny clicked off the radio as they were walking out. Billy Grammer's hit song was playing. Wanna see my baby? Wanna see her bad? She's the best girl this poor boy ever had. A few minutes later, Jean and Heinrich pulled up in front of a small yellow house on the corner of Crestwood and Longwood Drive. Judy met them at the door holding their baby girl in her arms. She was 6 months pregnant with their next child. Jean put his arms around her and pulled her close. It was as if he had not seen her in months. She pushed him back and laughed. What's gotten into you? Jean just smiled at Heinrich and replied, This is a great day.
My dad stopped talking and looked at me. He didn't have to say anything else. I knew exactly what he meant. Chapter 42. Death of the Boy Who Loved to Catch. Gene Moore spent the rest of his life devoted to his friends and family. He drove a bread delivery truck from 1954 through 1973. He had no love or passion for such mundane work. It was just a job, something he did to make a living, to support all of us. And then, in 1973, his life changed again. Exactly how it happened, I'm not sure, but Gene took a job selling vacuum cleaners with Filter Queen, a direct-selling company. He loved it. For the first time since being cut from the game of baseball, Gene was passionate about his work. He loved to sell, and he was very good at it. After less than a year, he was the number one Filter Queen salesperson in the nation. In 1974, Gene and Judy Moore started their own Filter Queen distributorship. They worked hard and well together, night and day, to make their little venture succeed. And it did. The whole family helped in the business. When I graduated from college in 1976, I began working with my mom and dad full-time. Together, we built a successful selling operation with more than 50 employees. Gene Moore had found a renewed sense of purpose and direction in his life. To him, conducting business was a game, a challenge. It was something to go to bed thinking about and something to look forward to doing again the next morning. Friday, May 13th, 1983, started like any other day. Gene climbed out of bed at 7 a.m., took a shower, and enjoyed a cup of coffee with Judy while watching Good Morning America. He arrived at work about 9 a.m., placed a few phone calls, joked with and motivated some of his employees, and then drove to Chicago Heights for a luncheon meeting with me. During lunch, Dad made an uncharacteristic statement. Well, today is Friday the 13th, he told me. This is the first of three Friday the 13th this year. If I make it through this day, I think I'll be okay. His observation struck me as odd because Gene was not a superstitious guy. Maybe he was just joking around, but it did not sound like it. To this day, I don't know why he said it. After lunch, Gene drove to another appointment in the western suburbs of Chicago and had dinner with Chuck Smith, a business associate. Dad left for home about 6:30 p.m. and arrived 2 hours later after fighting his way through rush hour traffic. He was pale and exhausted when Judy met him at the door. Dad had already removed his sport coat and loosened his tie. When Judy saw him, he was holding his left arm. His watch, which he wore on his left wrist, was later found on the floor of his car. Judy hugged him and helped him into the house, where he collapsed on the floor. He died there, with Judy by his side. Gene Moore left Judy's life while lying on the floor, the same place he had entered it. He was just 57 years old. Judy was the only person who knew the intimate details about Gene's remarkable life story until my dad opened up and bared his soul to me just 24 short hours before he died. It was Judy who had shared his secret, his burden, his inner turmoil. She provided the strength Gene needed to carry on. My mom never remarried. She lived in Indianapolis, Indiana, until her death on January 3, 2004. She told everyone until the end of her life that the only man she ever really loved was Gene, and that was enough for her. Looking back now, decades later, I realize just how little I really knew about my parents when I was growing up. A few memorable incidents from the shadowy past of my youth only make sense now. The passage of time has a way of clarifying what was once confusing. When I was about 12 years old, I was shopping with Mom and Dad at Montgomery Ward's. Dad wandered off, and I followed him into the sporting goods department. He stopped in front of a rack of baseball bats on an aisle end cap. I had no idea what was going on in his head, but I could tell his mind was somewhere else. He slowly reached for a bat and slid it carefully out of the rack. He took it in his hands lovingly, as if he was holding something he adored. I stood next to him and heard him say slowly and softly, "You know, there are no two of these in the world that are exactly alike." I didn't say anything because it was obvious he was not talking to me. "Everyone is different," he continued, "slightly different in weight." As he held the bat in his left hand, he began running the index finger of his right hand carefully and deliberately along the grain. The balance and feel, the grain pattern from different cuts of the same tree or a different tree altogether, make each bat unique. The bat has to match the personality of the batter, or they're unequally yoked. But when you find the perfect match, it is as if magic happens. Every bat has its own personality and temperament. He sighed. "No, there are no two bats alike anywhere." I was just a young kid and so had no idea what he was talking about. What I do remember is how much it bothered me because it did not sound anything like the dad I knew. I'd never heard him talk that way before about anything, especially baseball. As we both stood there staring at the same object, but seeing two entirely different things, my mom walked up behind us, put her hand on Gene's shoulder, and slowly turned him to face her. The bat he was holding slowly dropped to my dad's side, where it hung loosely gripped in his left hand. He took a deep breath, sighed deeply, reached out his right arm, and pulled her close. They embraced for what seemed to me an eternity. Looking back, I understand now he was transferring the emotion that holding the bat churned inside of him into his wife, the only person in the world who could truly understand what he was thinking and feeling at that moment. Another incident about this time has also remained forever with me. One day my dad came home from work and looked more excited than I'd ever seen him. "Gary, the Pittsburgh Pirates are in town to play the Cubs," he told me. "How would you like to go see the game?" A big league game at Wrigley Field? Was he kidding? I couldn't believe it. He had never taken me to a game. In fact, he rarely mentioned the word baseball and would not even play catch with me. "Dad, are you serious? Really?" "Yeah," he answered with a big smile. "Yes," I answered with an explosion of youthful enthusiasm. We reached Wrigley Field early. We guided our way down to where the players were taking batting practice. We stood there for several minutes, my eyes glued on the first major league ball players I'd ever seen in my life. My dad looked around, stiffened, narrowed his eyes, and called out a single name. "Roy! Elroy, Roy, Face," a pitcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates and one of the country's best, turned to see who was calling his name. When he saw my dad, the pitcher's jaw dropped. "Gene!" he shouted before trotting over to where we were standing. Roy was one of the finest relievers in the game. I remember he greeted my dad warmly, and they talked for some time. Unfortunately, I have no recollection of exactly what they talked about. I just remember standing there in awe as my dad chatted with one of my idols. A few minutes later, they said their goodbyes, and we walked back up into the stands and found our seats. I could not believe what I had just witnessed. "Dad," I began, "how do you know a pitcher like Roy Face?" My dad just shrugged. "Roy's an old friend. I knew him a long time ago." "How did you meet him?" I asked, hoping to continue the conversation. "It's not important, Gary. Let's watch the game." He refused to say anything more about it. Today, Roy Face is a candidate for the Baseball Hall of Fame. He played his final game in August of 1969. Like Ray, Roy is also best remembered for throwing a pitch called a forkball. The love of baseball was something that never left Dad. He suppressed, even hid his past, revealing it now and again only to my mom. I really don't know why. If he could have shared it with others, I think his life would have been much richer. Perhaps he could have reconciled the events that led him to the deep grief he suffered through the loss of his baseball career. He chose instead to hold his pain deep inside and only show his children the face of a loving father who worked hard and supported his family. Inside, he was fighting an entirely different war, battling demons that denied him the life he felt destined to live. My dad was hospitalized 4 times in my life because of bleeding ulcers. Once, while the rest of our family was away for the weekend, we returned to find him in bed, barely conscious. He had lost a tremendous amount of blood, which, according to his doctor, should have killed him. The stomach ulcer had eaten through the wall of his stomach and into his aorta, a major artery. Dr. Burnett, who became a lifelong family friend, said to me at my father's funeral, "I always thought it would be his ulcers that took him, not a heart attack." Knowing full well that health problems are hereditary, I asked the doctor if I should be more careful about what I ate. He looked at me, smiled, and shook his head. "It is not what your father ate, Gary," he replied, "but what was eating him that caused the ulcers." After Dad's death, I found his Purple Heart in one of his dresser drawers. "I understand now about Dad's wound," I said to my mom. She smiled and looked at me, her eyes filling with tears. She didn't respond aloud, but her eyes held within them the story of their life together. The truth is that my father was wounded, and he carried the results of that injury with him for the rest of his life. His wound was not of the flesh, but of the spirit. Although his physical injury largely healed, the experience left an indelible scar in his heart no one around him could ever fully remove. Postscript. Except to his family and a few close friends, Gene Moore was lost to history, or so it seemed. He never played Major League Baseball. There are a few letters here and there, my father's conversation with me, and of course my mother and the many other people around the country I've since interviewed who remember him and his life in and out of baseball. All in all, however, there's precious little published detail about Gene's life in general, and in particular, his time in Louisiana. The German sailors of U-505 were held there under special terms that bypassed the rules of the Geneva Convention. This denied them not only Red Cross access, but contact with the outside world. There is no record of playing baseball with the enemy. Or is there? While conducting research for this book, I discussed life at Camp Ruston with Keith Gill, curator of U-505 at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry. When I brought up baseball, he shook his head. There is no mention of baseball. Some of the sailors remembered working in farm fields outside the camp. A few claimed to have worked in the timber industry. The odd thing about that, he continued, is it's not timber country. I don't think there's a sawmill close to Camp Ruston. Then why would they say that, I asked. I don't know, he continued. Some of the U-505 sailors claimed they left the camp to work at a place they called the lumberyard. Afterward. Since the first edition hardcover of Playing with the Enemy was published, new information has surfaced. In an effort to write the most accurate story of Gene's life, his town, and the times they shared together, I have made a few adjustments to dates and other minor facts to correct mistakes or fill in information I did not know when the first edition went to press. Joe Vino Caviglia was a mainstay of Cesar baseball and served as the umpire for many of the Egyptians' home games. Joe's granddaughter, Allison Caviglia Barish, read my book and shared his name with me. I later met Allison and her husband Mark during a visit to Pittsburgh. Allison and I seemed to be kindred spirits in our love for Cesar, even though neither of us ever lived there. I've only been able to find one photograph of Gene playing with the Egyptians. Try as I might, when the first edition went to press in 2006, the only player I could identify was my dad. Thankfully, several people have come forward to name a father, a brother, or an uncle, and their names appear in this edition. Let me be the first to extend a hearty welcome to umpire Joe Caviglia and Gene's Egyptian teammates, Barney Daniels, Harry Boyd, Walter Klein, and Hobart Sammons. They were always there, but now history knows their names. A woman approached my table at a book signing in Heron, Illinois, clutching an old black-and-white photograph of her relatives, Heavy and Ezra Turner. As readers of Playing with the Enemy know, Gene refers to Heavy as the town philosopher. The chapter, Resurrection, takes place inside Heavy Turner's cafe. The photo appears in this new edition on page 217. I also learned a funny little story about Heavy and my dad. Heavy used to keep a bowl of hard candy on the counter. When my dad was young, he and his friends would sit at Heavy's counter, where one of them would distract Heavy by asking a question or dropping something, while the other reached up and snatched a piece of candy. The boys thought they were pulling something over on Heavy, but he knew it all the time. He put the candy out there and played their games so the boys could have fun thinking they were fooling old Heavy Turner. We now know that locals from around Ruston, Louisiana, watched Gene and his teammates play ball with the German prisoners from U-505. This is documented in Wesley Harris's book about Camp Ruston, Fish Out of Water. Sonny, a reader from Florida, called to fill in a small piece of my father's life during his tenure with the Cesar Egyptians. As a young boy, Sonny often helped out with the team. One day, the team was loading into three pickup trucks to drive to the championship game in Litchfield, Illinois. Because Sonny was too young to play, the older guys made the decision to leave him behind. As the trucks pulled away, Gene spotted Sonny standing alone, visibly heartbroken at being left behind. Gene jumped out of the truck and refused to make the trip unless the team made room for Sonny. The Egyptians were not about to leave their star catcher behind, so the guys squeezed together to make room. "That's just the kind of man your dad was," explained Sonny. Beyond the new information, there's another story playing out in Cesar, Illinois, which verifies the old adage that truth really is stranger than fiction. No one expected this. Mayor Mitchell certainly didn't. So when people from across the country began showing up unannounced in Little Cesar, Illinois, heads turned and eyebrows rose. The visitors walked or drove slowly down the streets, stood on street corners, and asked for directions to the lumberyard or to the little house on the corner of Matthew and Mulberry. The locals often spot visitors sitting quietly on curbs or in their cars with no particular destination in mind. Just being there was what was important. Most of the visitors, all readers of Playing with the Enemy, can't explain why they made the trip. They just knew it was something they had to do. Cesar, the wonderful small Midwestern town featured in Playing with the Enemy, has never been a magnet for visitors or national attention. Since the first release of my book in 2006, Cesar and its country boy, who could hit the ball a country mile, have attracted attention from across the country and even around the world. No one expected that my father's story would generate such a deep passion in the hearts, minds, and souls of readers, or that it would be such a success. No one had ever heard of my dad, and as a first-time author, no one had ever heard of me. Who would buy such a book? And after reading it, why would they take hours or days out of their busy lives to travel to Cesar? It took me a while, but I think I understand now. An outpouring of thanks and emotion reaches me daily. Each letter, phone call, or email touches me deeply, and I'm grateful for each and every one. Everyone has a dream, a goal, and a desire for his or her life. Reality has a way of interrupting those dreams. Some people have a very hard time coming to terms with setbacks and failure. As Gene's remarkable life in and out of baseball makes plain, it is not whether we reach our dream that is important in life, but who we become along the way. I'm so thankful that Playing with the Enemy inspires people to talk about their own family stories and connect with their parents, children, and long-lost friends. Most of the correspondence or phone calls I receive are very similar. Each begins with kind words about the book, but go on to relate a very personal story. Sometimes it's about a missed opportunity in life and the pain and learning to deal with it. Readers often share stories about their fathers or mothers, brothers, sisters, or friends, and how fate dealt them a difficult, haunting blow. The healing aspect of Gene's life story, and scores of people have used that adjective to describe it, connects with people from all walks of life and inspires them to connect and reconnect with their own families and loved ones. With their permission, I'd like to share a few of these letters with you. The first letter I received was from a man who has since become a good family friend. "We are baseball people," Jim L. began. "My grandson had his bar mitzvah at Dodger Stadium 3 years ago. I've had season tickets at Dodger Stadium for more than 45 years. However, this was not a baseball story. It truly was a story of love, warmth, character, and belief." Jim explained that Playing with the Enemy is the only book he, his son, and his grandson could enjoy and discuss together. Steve R., a lawyer from the Chicago suburbs, shared his love for my dad's story in a way, I suspect, quite unlike his normal lawyer-like personality. Steve has recommended the book to numerous people and even organized a private reading and signing in his home that was attended by more than 50 of his colleagues. Gene's inspirational story moved these tough Chicago lawyers in an unexpected and profound way. Steve's passion has touched my family and me deeply. One particularly moving call was from a judge. Someone left a copy of my book in his courtroom, and he read it. "Your dad's story has helped me see how fortunate I am and how successful and meaningful my life has been. It also helped him understand and appreciate his brother's unsuccessful baseball career with a major league team." The connections with readers across the country are as varied as they are heartfelt. A Vietnam veteran told me how a war injury ended his football career and how Gene Moore's quiet struggle moved him to tears and helped him deal with his loss. A 12-year-old boy explained that Playing with the Enemy so inspired him that he was dedicating his baseball season to my dad. The book inspired a pair of songs, Field of Broken Dreams by Pat Hegewald, Mary Cairo, and Matt Meyer, and I May Be Down, But I'm Not Out by Mike Paleo. The pride of the Egyptians lives on in the hearts and minds of readers around the corner and across the globe. Gene Moore's story doesn't end with the hometown boy hitting a home run and winning the game. It is not amenable to tying up in a neat little package with a bow on top. Life is not perfect, and neither was Gene. Bad things do happen to good people, and our dreams do not always become our reality. But in the end, Gene learned that his life was worth living, even without his dream, and that the skills the one-time baseball prodigy used so well on a baseball diamond were just as valuable raising a strong family, building a successful business, and making a legion of friends. His is a shining example of a life well lived.
We hope you've enjoyed Playing with the Enemy, an Oasis audio production under arrangement with Savas Beattie. This program was produced by Tim Lundeen and Jay Payleitner. Text copyright 2008 by Gary Moore. Production copyright 2008 by Oasis Audio, under arrangement with Savas Beattie.